And now another takedown of an illusion about manhood.
Young men have sex. Everybody says so, so it must be true.
That's Chicago-based freelance writer Noah Berlatsky.
Well, when I was in college, I slept with no one. Never, ever. Not even a little bit. I didn't kiss a woman until I was in my late 20s when I met my now wife. She was determined, and thank goodness. There's so much discussion about young men and sex that you may think that my long sexless stretch was aberrant or abnormal. Certainly it felt that way at the time. The most painful part of being a virgin wasn't so much that I wasn't having sex, nor was it that I was lonely, since I had plenty of good friends. Rather, the painful part was that I felt like I was not being a man in the right way, that I was a failure. Futile crush blurred into futile crush, and I just sat there, doing nothing. Men were supposed to do things. Men were supposed to have salacious anecdotes. Men were supposed to have sex. I wasn't having sex. So what did that make me? Some not-man thing, wrong and broken and ashamed. But the truth is, it's just not that weird to not have sex in college. A 2011 National Center for Health Statistics study found that a full quarter of 18 and 19-year-olds of both genders hadn't had sex. Even among 20 to 24-year-olds, more than 10% remained virgins. Roles have changed a lot over time, but one thing that hasn't changed is that masculinity is still defined in large part by failure. The images of perfect ideal men are everywhere, from Superman getting Lois Lane to James Bond getting everyone else. Being a man means failing to be good enough, and failing to measure up. Freud was wrong. It's not women who are defined by penis envy. It's men. And in worrying all the time about penises, men end up treating women as a means to an end. A woman becomes a way for you to be more manly, rather than a person in her own right. It's hard to treat women well when you're obsessed with manliness. So how do we stop being obsessed with it? I have to admit, I'm not sure. Being married has certainly made the issue less pressing for me personally. But at the same time, there still is temptation to make the story about its ending, to say, I was not a man in the past, and then I got married, and now I'm a man. Ta-da! The manly thing seems to be to belittle the younger me in order to better flaunt the older, sex-having me. But the truth is, I wasn't always sad in my 20s. I'm not always happy now. And for that matter, the guy my wife liked enough to pursue, there wasn't anything wrong or weird about him just because he never had sex. He wasn't a failure. He was just a virgin. Which is one not uncommon way of being a man.
Freelance writer Noah Berlatsky. He's also the editor of the comics and culture blog, The Hooded Utilitarian.
And finally, as we mentioned, our last broadcast is scheduled for August 1st. So as we wind down our production, we thought it would be nice to hear about the music that members of our staff are listening to as part of our regular series, In Your Ear. This Monday, we thought we'd hear from our summer intern, Miles Johnson. And here's what's on his playlist.
Hi, I'm Miles, and this is what's playing in my ear. Good Enough by XXYYXX is amazing. It's a song that I think is important and a song that I play a lot because of its context. He is a young black electronic musician, which is rare, and he's sampling TLC, which I think is even rarer for that genre of music, and it's fun. So another song that's playing in my ear and has been for a while now is Warm Winds by SZA and Isaiah Rashad.
Hey, hey, Lord Child, hey. Hey, Lord Child, don't you worry. Stuttering, shaking our feet. Beauty's never given.
These are two really young artists who have recorded this song together, and even though the latter is a rapper, SZA is this really unique, unconventional artist, and she has this really different voice. I always think, you know, she reminds me of someone, and it's almost on the tip of my tongue, but I could never really place it. And I feel like that's what really draws me to her music as a whole. She does sound so different, and I always feel really relaxed listening to this song, especially, but really captivated by this just different, interesting sounding voice. Come on today. You could
come on today. Experiment Black Radio.
Another song playing in my ear right now is Black Radio by Robert Glasper. Even though Yasiin Bey, who many people will know better as Mos Def, is the only voice you hear on the track, Robert Glasper plays all the instruments and does all the production, so it's really his song. And I feel like the reason this has always resonated, it does a great job of allowing hip-hop to sort of come out of this box that I feel like it gets put in often. It's still a secret even when you tell them dumb dummies. Hush money, rent receipt, drug money. They're cold-blooded, warm gun money. The chief rock, a fuel injector, Zulu horse, Papa Love, Boogie, bay, 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 bay. And though, you know, there is rapping on this track, it's not your typical hip-hop track. But then again, like, what is typical? And I think that that is what makes this unique. I think that's what Robert Glasper really did well, was really make an interesting sort of track that makes you think a little bit differently about music and the way that we categorize it. You are rocking with the fresh. Yes, you are rocking with the best. You are rocking with the fresh. You are rocking with the depth. You are rocking with the yes. Now you are rocking with the best. You're rocking with the fresh, you are rocking with your depth, it's the yes.
That was Tell Me More intern Miles Johnson telling us what's playing in his ear.
Some Republicans are seeking their own ways to address income inequality.
They do not use that phrase, which is associated with the left-leaning Occupy movement.
Nor have they taken up a campaign against the 1%, but they are talking of the gap between the wealthy and the poor.
Those Republicans include Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who's considering a presidential run.
The real challenge of the 21st century is we are not creating enough of those higher-paying jobs that the 21st century makes possible. And we have too many people that don't have the skills for those jobs.
Now, Republican rhetoric in recent years has focused on getting government out of people's economic lives. The T in Tea Party stands for taxed enough already. Many conservatives argue federal aid just creates dependency. Without disowning those ideas, some Republicans say they want to help struggling families. In May, Jeb Bush warned against an economy where some people are permanently on top and others are stuck at the bottom. Senator Rubio has been proposing legislation with colleagues from both parties. He says he wants to make it easier to pay back student loans or for people to qualify for jobs without a college degree. When we met in Senator Rubio's office, he gave his definition of the problem.
It's not income inequality per se. Income inequality, you know, the best way I would describe income inequality versus opportunity inequality is if you're the cashier at Burger King, of course you make less than the manager or even the CEO. The issue is not that. The issue is whether you're stuck being a cashier for the rest of your life or do you have a real opportunity to improve yourself so that you can get a better paying job, maybe even not work for Burger King, but somewhere else. And so what we need to do is figure out, well, what is it that's holding people back from being able to do that? And try to do what we can to address it within the confines of what a limited government should be doing. And that's what we have focused on.
Now, the thing about limited government gets to something that's interesting for me. Does the Republican Party have a special problem in trying to focus on helping that cashier, say, because the party ideologically or philosophically believes that the government really can't do much to target economically specific groups of people?
I don't think that's an accurate assessment of the... I think at its core, conservatism is not an anti-government movement, and it's not a no-government movement. It's not an anarchist movement. The conservative movement is about government playing its important yet limited role and about not falling into the trap of believing that every problem has an exclusive government answer for it, recognizing that much of what will happen in our lives and much of what determines the direction of our country are things that occur outside of government. There are things that occur inside the home. There are things that occur within society. There are decisions that individuals make. And so forth. I mean, but there is a role for government to play, and while it is not, in my mind, the predominant role, it is still a significant and important one, and it needs to play that role in a positive way.
But you know what I'm suggesting? A lot of people in the Republican Party are skeptical of how much good economic intervention by the government can do,
but again,
particularly
in the lives
of individuals.
And I understand that's the way the debate's been framed for much of the 20th century. I don't accept those constructs for that debate. I think in the 21st century, let's look at a real-life story, right? If you're a single mother with limited education, maybe you dropped out of high school, or that's all you have. You've been abandoned by the father of your children, and you're struggling to raise two kids on a $10 an hour job. Government has a limited but important role to play. For example, there are things government can do to incentivize the creation of innovations in education that are accessible to people like you, because if you have to work full-time and raise a family, you can't just drop everything and go into a traditional four-year college program. There are things government can do through our tax code to allow you to keep more of the money that you make, particularly when you look at the cost of childcare or the general cost of raising a family.
When you picked specific groups of people you wanted to help, why did single mothers make that list?
Because I know a bunch of them, and I've talked about this for years. In fact, that I'll just pick it now. If you go back to 2005, when I was designated to be the next Speaker of the Florida House, in my speech, that's the example that I used. I used the story of a young single mother who wanted everything that had gone wrong for her to go right for her children. Those aren't the only people struggling in America, but they are disproportionately. There are millions of women who are trapped in lower-paying jobs and don't have the skills for a higher-paying job and don't have the money or the time to access the higher education they need for a better job. And so for the rest of their lives, they're stuck making $10 an hour, and their kids, as a result, don't have opportunities either.
Is there sympathy for single moms, but also skepticism towards solutions, because a lot of people think, well, actually, just the father ought to be there, and any help you give, the single mom just allows the father not to be there.
That would be ideal, but sometimes that's not the mother's fault. I mean, the man has abandoned her. He was abusive. The fact of the matter is, yes, the ideal setting, and they would be the first ones to tell you that, we know that there's a success sequence. The success sequence in America says you get an education, you get a good job, you get married, you have children. And people that do those four things have an incredible chance of economic stability. But there are millions of people that aren't going to have one or any of those four things. They are not going to have an equal opportunity to succeed unless something happens to equalize the situation. And then the question for those of us in public policy is, what can a limited government do to be a part of that solution? Not the exclusive solution, but a part of that solution.
I was listening to a political analyst, Amy Walter, the other day. She was talking about Hillary Clinton, who was having some trouble at the moment. Because Clinton was being perceived as being out of touch. She said something about leaving the White House and being dead broke. Amy Walter, the political analyst, said, that would be a problem for Hillary Clinton if she ever faced a Republican Party that was itself in touch with the middle class, and she didn't think that was the case. Do you think that the Republican Party has had trouble connecting with ordinary people?
Well, look, I think that too often times, and I've heard others say this point as well, that we focus solely on job creators, and that's important. But
business
most
owners.
People aren't employers, they're employees. But I also think that the real challenge for both parties is I think neither party has made the transition to the 21st century. We're still having 20th century debates. It's an argument about how much or how little we need to invest in higher education, and not enough on the fact that our higher education system is completely antiquated. If you are a 30-year-old with two children who needs to go back to school, how do you do that in a cost-effective way while you still work and raise your family? I think that in the 21st century, people should be allowed to package learning no matter how they acquired it. Through life experience, work experience, free online courses, one course at a community college, another at another community college. You should be able to package all of that cumulative learning into the equivalent of a degree that allows you to be employed. I wish we spent more time on those sorts of things.
Okay, many people grow up knowing the story of Charlotte's Web, a spider with literary talent saves a pig named Wilbur from the slaughterhouse. Now from Robertson County, Kentucky, we have the story of two pigs from an endangered breed. The catch here is that experts say in order to save pigs like them, they need to be eaten. Leslie Gutman reports.
Come here, buddy.
Luther, a red wattle pig, is stuck in a mud pit. All 700 pounds of him. Farmer Travis Hood hoses water on Luther, while his 9-year-old daughter Taylor sprinkles feed on the ground to try and motivate the pig to climb out. Luther and his fellow red wattles are a threatened breed, according to a group called the Livestock Conservancy. There's only about 6,000 of them in the United States. Hood is one of a small group of farmers raising them.
15, 20 years ago, there were less than 50 of this breed of hog. And because of slow food movements, it has made a comeback. So because they're desirable and finding themselves into restaurants and farmers markets, you're giving us a reason to raise them.
That slurping is Lucy, a 650-pound sow eating lunch. Lucy's 5 years old and the farm matriarch. She's earth-toned with the trademark wattles. Those are pieces of cartilage about 4 inches long that hang down from either side of her neck. This tiny county seems an unlikely place to find a campaign for genetic diversity in our country's food system. But Warren Beeler of the state's Department of Agriculture says what Hood is doing is critical.
You don't want to lose any genetics, because when you do, you lose it forever. And so the red wattles, they take a step back in terms of being those kind of hogs that will survive very well out in the open, where the hogs that we've got now probably couldn't handle that. That's a degree of toughness.
Greg Renfro, a meat scientist at the University of Kentucky, says red wattles don't add much to global food production because heritage pig breeds take longer to get to market than conventionally raised pigs.
When we start to solve the problem of how we're going to feed 9 billion people, you know, we have to make sure that not only we were able to feed all these people, but we're able to feed them cheaply.
Just looking to see what you have.
Three kinds of bacon.
And red wattle meat isn't cheap. At this farmer's market in Lexington, Kathy Watkins buys some of Hood's bacon for $13 a pound, almost double what she'd pay for bacon in the supermarket. She fries it up for breakfast the next morning and says it tastes different from regular bacon.
How is it?
This is delicious. It's got kind of a deeper, a smoky kind of a taste going.
Hood says this year he sold almost 3.5 tons of pork products at farmers markets and to restaurants. The farm turned a profit for the first time. It's the payoff from a risk he took 5 years ago when he left his 16-year career as a golf course superintendent.
It went from a salary position with full benefits down to an hourly position, no benefits. So I thought, well, at the very least, we can feed ourselves. So we got a couple of hogs to, you know, supply our own meat. Well, it started to snowball.
Well, you had it.
Hood's entire family works on this 78-acre farm, but his daughter, Taylor, is very different from Fern, the girl in Charlotte's Web. Fern wanted to save Wilbur from the slaughterhouse, not Taylor.
I honestly think it's good for just us, the world, because fresh pork is good pork.
Hood is a little more sentimental, about Lucy at least, his favorite pig. His first pig. He says it'll be a sad day when he drives her to the slaughterhouse, sometime in the next several months.
It takes a certain mindset in order to do it, because you do get attached to him.
Luther has more time on the farm, another 2 years or so, and then Hood will sell him for breeding. Meanwhile, Luther's still trying to extricate himself from the mud. Hood shrugs and moves on to more farm chores. He says when Luther gets hungry enough, he'll stop complaining and muster the energy to climb out. Leslie Gutman, Lexington, Kentucky.
Well, here's one way a few nonprofits are trying to eliminate the high unemployment rate among young blacks and Latinos: create a gateway to highly sought-after tech jobs. In Oakland, California, just outside of Silicon Valley, a lot of young people are wondering how they can move from fast food counters, say, to high-tech desk jobs. NPR's Arthi Shahani tagged along with one young woman who's trying to make the leap.
This high-tech story starts at Taco Bell.
Order 209.
Come on now. French fry. You have a nice day, okay?
Tanika Armstrong makes burrito supremes and sells Coke. She counts pennies and quarters, and she gets orders from her bosses, who can be pretty condescending.
They just be like, oh, did you know that already, or... can you do this? I was like, yes, I've been doing it for almost a year now.
Armstrong lives two lives. This first one, which starts as early as 5 a.m., doesn't challenge her or pay well. That's why the 20-year-old set off in search of life number two.
I'm trying to do an outline of a website.
Armstrong is staring at a laptop in the offices of a small nonprofit called Hack the Hood. Hood because here in Oakland, California, things can get pretty rough, and hack because that's slang for making money in tech. Armstrong is spending her afternoons here this summer. Her job is to fix websites for clients.
There's a lot of other links, like you click on it, take you everywhere in the world. I like short and simple.
This summer, the teens will meet top talent from the companies that make all those apps they download. Armstrong says there is some chance she'll get deep into coding, or she might prefer a non-technical job in the tech sector, like sales and marketing. And that's okay.
Nobody ever asks young people that come from affluent neighborhoods why they're doing programs.
Zakiya Harris is a program instructor.
The more you expose young people to opportunities, the better that they're going to become as adults.
Harris's work with the teens is based on this question.
How can we empower them with some low-hanging fruit skills in the tech industry so they can start earning some money in their pocket that's going to actually lead to a career and not just a dead-end opportunity in a service job?
It's a really big question with a really small budget line. Frida Kaper-Klein is an investor in Silicon Valley and a leading philanthropist for coding nonprofits. She gives a few million dollars a year, and that's rare.
Foundations are giving tens of thousands of dollars for new programs, and in the aggregate, you might be getting hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Google recently gave Hack the Hood $500,000 after it won a competition. The tech company has pledged to give $50 million overall to programs in the U.S. and abroad that try to get women into computer science. Kaper-Klein is talking to Twitter and others, asking them to step up too.
What's going to distinguish tech companies going forward is who takes this seriously and who doesn't.
We were going to small local businesses and asking them if they wanted a website for their business.
Tanika Armstrong was at Hack the Hood last summer too, and she liked the challenge of pitching their services to business owners.
They was like, what's the catch? What's the catch? I was like, no, it's free.
Armstrong says that process can feel weird, but it's better than making burritos. Arthi Shahani, NPR News, Oakland.
During these dog days of summer for most American children, back-to-school season feels a long way off. Though not at one elementary school in North Carolina, which is kicking off its first full week of the new school year. From WCQS in Asheville, North Carolina, Greta Johnson explains why.
The kids are in their first day finest. New shoes, haircuts, there are even a couple of tutus. Parents are dropping off their children, and teachers are greeting them as they stream into Hall Fletcher Elementary.
So how many scholars will get out of this car?
Hey, Malik,
chess champion. Hey, Manny.
Here you go, bud.
In a white suit and bow tie, Principal Gordon Grant welcomes each student by name as they climb out of cars and grab their book bags. These kids are back after 5 weeks of summer vacation. That's about half of what they're used to. There are some sleepy faces, but for the most part, the students seem as excited as they normally are on the first day of school. Hall Fletcher is starting a 3-year experiment with the new year-round calendar. Here's Principal Grant.
Children who don't have really good, enriching opportunities provided for them in the summer move back academically.
Those kids often come from families that can't afford summer camps or vacations. About 80% of the kids here come from low-income families that qualify for free or reduced-price lunch. The kids will get the same amount of school, just distributed differently. There will be 5 weeks of summer break, then 2 3-week breaks in September and March, along with Christmas break. Tamara Owen is the grandmother of two Hall Fletcher students, one second grader and one kindergartner.
My second grader remembered his lunch number today. Last year, he couldn't remember it. And I was like, yes, they retain the things that they learned.
Sociology professor Carl Alexander at Johns Hopkins University has studied learning gaps between kids from different economic backgrounds.
Almost all that gap increase happened during the long summer break when all children's learning was dependent on the resources available to them and their families and their communities, with school out of the picture.
A couple years ago, Asheville City Schools tested kids in reading before and after summer breaks. Kelvin Cyrus is the assistant superintendent for the district.
Our numbers broke out the same way. You could tell during this school year, the growth was almost the same, a little bit more for those who were not economically disadvantaged. But that whole summer thing was right here at home.
Only about 3 or 4% of the schools in the United States operate on a year-round schedule, so there isn't much data to show how much of a boost they give kids. Paul Van Hippel has studied year-round education. He's with the University of Texas in Austin.
Students learn more in the summer because they're getting some instruction then, but they're learning less during the school year because they have these extra breaks. And over 12 months, the total amount that students learn doesn't change.
Helping the school transition to the new calendar is Evelina Pierce, an AmeriCorps volunteer. She went door-to-door with Principal Grant to convince families to try the new schedule. She says it helped that many of the parents here used to be Grant's students.
And he has built that relationship with people where they do trust that he is doing things to support them and their children.
But Pierce says she knows of at least three families who said they left Hall Fletcher because of the calendar change. This isn't Hall Fletcher's first experiment with year-round school either. Principal Grant says they tried it back in the 90s, but gave up on it.
After 3 years, they dropped it because of the mismatch of the balanced school year calendar with the regular school year calendar. I think we've done a better job of matching those calendars this year.
Cyrus, the assistant superintendent, says even if test scores don't improve, he still likes the idea of a year-round calendar. After all, the one we've got now is based on an agrarian lifestyle that most of us don't live by. For NPR News, I'm Greta Johnson.